Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and our guest today is Larry Krotz, who is a writer and documentary filmmaker who has written for the Globe and Mail, National Post, Literary Review of Canada, Saturday Night Live. Oh, Saturday Night Live, that's an interesting Saturday Night, and The Walrus. He's the author of a really great new book, Nothing Ordinary: The Story of the Northern Ontario School of Medicine. Larry Krotz, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
You know, this book, I have to say, is a very handsome book and very readable. And you mentioned in the afterword to this book that as an Ontarian, or Torontonian perhaps, you are kind of unhappy that, and maybe I guess I'm putting words in your mouth, embarrassed that we don't seem to know very much about this great accomplishment, the establishment of the Northern Ontario School of Medicine. As a matter of fact, we don't know much about Northern Ontario, which is what, 9/10 of Ontario?
9/10 of the geographic area of Ontario is.
Yes.
I got interested in this story when I was talking to a doctor in Thunder Bay about four years ago, and he kept talking about the Northern Ontario School of Medicine. And I had never heard of the Northern Ontario School of Medicine. And so I said to him, I said, Bill, how come I've never heard of the Northern Ontario School of Medicine? And he said, that's because you live in Toronto. And he was right. I went back to Toronto and I'd asked people, I said, have you ever heard of the Northern Ontario School of Medicine? He said, no, I haven't heard of the Northern Ontario School of Medicine. And so that piqued my interest. And I learned very quickly that the Northern Ontario School of Medicine had been established in the early 2000s. It accepted its first students in 2005. It came into play as a response to a lot of unhappiness in that 9/10 of Ontario, the North, in their inability to get and keep doctors. There was a perennial problem getting doctors to serve in the communities all across the North, whether those are small mining towns or lumbering towns, or whether they're Indigenous First Nations, and all kinds of strategies have been employed over 50 years to provide bribes for doctors to go and serve for 4 years or whatever. Anyway, the long and the short of it was that finally, folks of the North, including a lot of political people, such as mayors of various towns and communities, got so exasperated with this, and they said, okay, if we can't get doctors to come and stay and the province won't, solve that problem for us, we'll try to address the problem we'll train our own.
Yeah, individual in the book I remember seeing said, grow our own, right? That's a term.
Yeah, yeah. and there was some background, evidence that if you trained local people, they would stay. And they found that in other jurisdictions. And they also realized that they wanted to train for a very, the peculiar needs of the North, which are not the same as the needs of metropolitan Southern Canada. You've got scattered populations, widely spread. People do, a lot of people have dangerous jobs in either mining or lumbering. You have Indigenous populations. You've got a whole different profile of medical needs and a very rural and widely scattered population. And so they said, not only are we going to train our own doctors, but we're going to train our own doctors who've got the skills to address these specific needs. And they quickly linked up with their first dean of the school, Roger Strasser, who was, you know, a guy from the Australian outback with that, you know, one of the leading, you know, rural medicine theorists in the world, actually. And Roger came in and served as their first dean for the next, almost 20 years.
Yeah. Well, that's where the nothing ordinary part comes up. If you're going to create your own doctors out of and recruiting people from the north, and you focus on the two groups in particular, the French and indigenous, something's got to give on both sides of the equation, right? Because the medical establishment is not really used to the idea that you're going to have some sort of new method. And I noticed, for example, you have language, and I want to make sure I ask you about it. The longitudinal learning.
Oh, yeah.
Which is probably not a concept you'd get at the Toronto School.
Well, all kinds of medical training is changing quite rapidly now. And that longitudinal method is being adopted more and more. And it's
the
Southern medical establishment wasn't terribly happy with the idea of the North creating its own school. Two medical schools in Ontario, McMaster and Ottawa, had for several years been serving by sending their residents to McMaster was sending residents to Thunder Bay, and Ottawa was sending residents to Sudbury, and they felt that they were doing a pretty decent job with helping out Northern Ontario, but it was still a metropolis hinterland kind of model. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was that the Southern folks said, well, we already have, I think, 1, 2, 3, we already have 5 medical schools in Ontario. Do we need another one? That kind of thing. It's going to be expensive. And so the politics of it back, if you go back 20 years ago, were, skeptical. Some of these Northern guys stuck to it and made it happen. And that's why I like the subtitle of the book is sort of how 800,000 people in Northern Ontario invented their own medical school.
Yeah.
Because that's basically what they did.
And that's really remarkable. But please, one of the subjects you should tell us about, it is always so striking because, we talked to you a year or so ago about the book you did on diabetes amongst Indigenous people. And we had a lot of comments on that. And really at the center of it was remoteness and distance.
Yeah.
And people having to be flown from one place to another the inability to provide the necessary equipment at sites.
Yeah.
Now, this seems to be much the same territory for you.
Yes, it is. I mean, the reason I was having a conversation with the doctor in Thunder Bay was because of diabetes. I just finished with that book, and he's a nephrologist who does a lot of work with the First Nations in the northwest corner of the province. But distance is, distance is one of the prominent factors for anything you do in the north. And because of the COVID pandemic, we've all got used to Zoom meetings and doing all kinds of things at a distance. But these guys were doing it, 10 years earlier. the school recognized distance on a couple of levels right from the get-go. They have two campuses. They have a building in Sudbury and they have a building in Thunder Bay. And half of the students, at any given time, there are a couple hundred students because there's like 60, well, actually 300, because there's 64 students in each year. Half of those are in Thunder Bay and half of those are in Sudbury. And so they had set up classrooms with interactive television running, you know, between a classroom in Sudbury and a classroom in Thunder Bay so that all the students could take the same course at the same moment. And they'd done that well before all the rest of us were doing it because of the COVID pandemic. The other thing that is a big factor of the training of all kinds of medical people in the North is distance medicine, where, and this is becoming very, very sophisticated now, you've got some remote First Nation that's fly-in only, and you've got a nursing station there. They now, you know, are increasingly honing the technologies to allow you to do, you know, long distance diagnoses and long distance consultations and that kind of thing. And in order to do all that stuff, you got to train for all of that stuff. So that, you know, recognizing that as a factor of your community, that's a big part of the curriculum is working on those aspects of long distance medical and healthcare.
Yeah. Now, on the matter of the Indigenous, it was very ambitious. The goal of having someone, a Indigenous person, who takes an interest in medicine, is able to serve and stays in the community and wants to be in that community. And I think you said in the book that the Indigenous make up, 12% of the 800,000 we're talking about?
Yeah, about 12%, between 12 and 13%. And so the goal of the school was to have at least 12% Indigenous students. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there've been some bumps along the way, but basically that's what they've got right now is they pretty much that right on the nose of the student body. And another goal was to have 17-18% Francophone. And so those are not exactly quotas, but they're targets that they've been pretty good at finding ways to make them happen.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that that's true, of course, to the Francophone community. That's about, was it 25 or 22%, something like that?
A little less than that, but depends on whether you're a bilingual or solely Francophone or an allophone.
And they, the question of really involving the community and giving community, you might call it power. There's something called the Indigenous Reference Group, and there is the Francophone Reference Group.
Yep.
Did I get the title right?
You got the titles right. And so the leadership of the school decided very early on to do a lot of listening. And actually, the first event I went to when I started doing research for the book, I flew to Kenora, and I spent 3 days on the First Nation just south of the town of Kenora, where they had an Indigenous reference group meeting, and there was this beautiful octagonal log structure on their powwow grounds. And Indigenous health people from all across Northern Ontario, there were like 150 of them that were there. And like 3 days of drumming and tobacco smudging and people talking at great length about both their frustrations and their hopes, mm-hmm. and giving feedback to the people who were running the medical school. It was quite an extraordinary. It's quite an extraordinary 3 days, and quite a way, you know, as a researcher, it's a great way to jump in and get my feet wet.
Yeah. Also, you point out there's now a new sort of intersection here of with traditional medicine, where it is also a respectful exchange, whereas the previous model, you might say, is a colonial model of, no, we bring the whole package, and you're going to do it our way. And I think you used actually diabetes as an example. One place where you say, well, given the failures actually in a coping with diabetes, treatment of diabetes, it's they benefit from discussing traditional medicine.
Yeah, no, I mean this is a slowly evolving field. Medicine comes out of the scientific method, right? Comes out of the Enlightenment.
What we say?
It's it's, you know, traditionally it is it's hierarchical. It's based on pharmaceuticals. It's based on, you know, interventions that are scientific in their basis. And we know, I mean, Western medicine is not the only medicine in the world. If you witness the millions of people who adhere to Chinese medicine, or the hundreds of thousands who follow homeopathic medicine, and indigenous healing is, you know, in that camp. But because of colonialism in Canada, the indigenous healers pretty much, they didn't disappear, but they pretty much went underground. And for many decades were...
It was illegal in some
places. It was illegal, yeah. And so ceremonies and various plant potions and sweats and things like that were... As you say, they weren't just frowned upon; they were illegal, and so it's a long journey to move back and try to find ways to respect and integrate other traditions in healthcare against the powerful hegemony of the Western method. But, you know, in the last 20 years, there's a lot that's, slowly by slowly gaining some traction in that area and being integrated into, that's one of the things that the school, you know, if you've got a medical school, you kind of struggle with, okay, how do we handle traditional healing if that is part of the community experience of, mm-hmm. 10 or 20% of our population? And yet we need to run a school that adheres to the kind of hard and fast standards of, you know, a Western system of grading and accreditation. Mm-hmm. So they're always working on that. And there are a lot of meetings happen around that. Well, and I don't know, I don't know where it'll end up, but it's an interesting roadmap to keep an eye on.
Yes, well, it is. This is such a new phenomenon, but you know, frankly, I mean, this matter of knowing about it, I did not know about the Northern Ontario School of Medicine. I did know that. And by the way, it's, in my view, it's clearly a success story. And it's certainly one that you would want to see emulated and or worked at to make it a continuing and broadening success.
I think it's a good news story. I mean, the interesting thing about any enterprise is the struggles that it goes through and the trials and errors and all of that kind of thing. And the book hopes not to pull any punches and all of that, because it hasn't always been easy and it won't be easy going into the future. Mm-hmm. But I think, how can I say this? It's an important enterprise for Northern Ontario. Is a kind of an interesting place because of how it's been treated like a colony, in the sense that Northern Ontario is a very rich place, but the money comes to Bay Street. Mm-hmm. The money doesn't stay in Timmins. The gold that comes out of the ground in Timmins has been worth billions. Early in the last century, 28% of the Ontario government's revenue came from royalties on minerals from the north. So you go up there and you cut the trees and you dig out the ore, and then everybody.
And it gets dark and the lights go on in Toronto.
And it's that kind of attitude that pervades all kinds of things, including medicine. We say, okay, we'll run medicine for the north from Toronto. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so that's why setting up a school in the north was a political battle.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, in this battle, you note something that is underappreciated, the growing political acumen and will of the indigenous leaders. There's a man, I don't know how to pronounce his name, I think it's Gois Kakagamic.
Kakagamic, yeah, yeah.
And it seems to be a central figure, and he seems to be like, listen, I want this, don't play with me.
Mr. Kakagamic, who's also an artist, he's quite a well-known artist. He's from Northwestern Ontario, and he championed having a branch of the school in Thunder Bay and not just having one school in Sudbury. And so that's where he came in. The Indigenous political leaders are an interesting lot, because they had high hopes for this school, and I suspect many of them still do, but they haven't been reticent in their criticisms. They've pushed for things that would be of interest, in the interests of their communities, and also in the whole issue of making sure a good proportion of students were Indigenous. So they've been vocal on that, and I think the Indigenous politics in the North will become very, very interesting in the next few years, as we go into some economic development things, such as the mining of the Ring of Fire area, which is this vast basin of mineral wealth that is up till now has been too far away for anybody to go in and properly have a go at it. But with the demands for minerals exploding over the next 40 years, especially the kinds of minerals that you use in batteries and things like that, there will be a lot of mining activity in the north, and the degree to which the indigenous nations can keep any control of that is going to be right on the table.
Yeah, you quoted a gentleman, James Morris, and reading him, and as a matter of fact, he introduced the word, which you haven't heard, I haven't heard this term for a while, but I always believed in it, affirmative action. And he's, if I understood his point, he's, it's this matter of making sure that sort of artificial barriers are challenged, and so that access for indigenous people, people of the North, get a second look or a third look, an opportunity in order to guarantee these numbers and to find people committed to not only, you know, to medicine and rural medicine, but who will go and live in the community and be of the community and not go away.
Yeah. James Morris is an indigenous political leader in the Sioux Lookout region. And what he was talking about particularly there was access for indigenous students who, you know, some of whom might need help completing high school in order to go to medical school. So they have had to recognize that again, the model of who gets into medical school, it used to be kind of tried and true you came from a pretty select group if you got into medical school in the first place, and that has the, in order to expand that, you got to do some tinkering with a lot of assumptions.
Yeah. Just a very important matter, and by the way, we're speaking to Larry Krotz, and the book is Nothing Ordinary, The Story of the Northern Ontario School of Medicine. The concept, it strikes me as very idealistic, and the people you interview in the book is interspersed with really interesting interviews where the people participating speak for themselves, talking to you, or some of them appear to be written out themselves.
Yeah, those are mostly graduates of the school I went around and visited. Yeah.
And so it's really, of course, their remarks are very vivid. But one thing they all like is the term, which is at the center of all this, is social accountability. Mm-hmm. It kept cropping up all over. I rarely see in any field of study where they say this is what we're aiming at.
Yeah.
Is that coming from Dr. Strasser, or where is this?
Well, it comes from Dr. Strasser and the new dean, or not new, she's been there a couple of years now, the second dean, Dr. Sarita Verma. It's quite impressive because front and center is this constant awareness of who you're working for. Why are we training doctors? We're training doctors so that we can provide health care to little towns like Chapleau and First Nations like any of the 60 First Nations and even smaller cities like Timmins or Sault Ste. Marie. The needs and the agendas of these places are part, that's what they consider to be their accountability mandate, and they really take it seriously.
There's a young man that you spoke to who's just effusive. He says, I love this idea of social accountability. I thought about it. I worked on it. What does it mean? And then he says, it means this and for the community and for basically ended up talking about the world. I mean, it was very striking. And of course, I mean, we're talking about people, it better be motivated, right? Because they spend months actually in very remote areas. You really got to believe in this.
Well, in many of the cases, those remote areas are home.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the stories I liked, and it's in the book, is a guy. There are a lot of second career people have gone into medicine through NOSM and are serving up north. So there was this guy, he was born and raised in Dryden, which is a paper mill town of about, 8,000 people west of Thunder Bay. So this guy grew up in Dryden, and he came south to university, and he got a PhD in chemistry. And he had a big job in somewhere in the chemical industry down in Southern Ontario. And he and his wife were driving back to Dryden for a summer holiday with his family. And on the radio, they heard on the CBC that there was going to be a medical school opened in Northern Ontario. And he decided on the spot while he was driving in his car at, age 35 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
To go to medical school. Now he's a doctor in Dryden, his old hometown.
Well, yes.
So you have, and one of the indigenous young women she lives in Thunder Bay, but she does fly in to the First Nation where her mother grew up.
Yeah. And that one's they're all striking me. Yes, that's a very touchy story. There was the woman who said that told the story of the kid looking in the door and watching.
Yeah, that's Rebecca. Yeah, same
and
woman.
She was the first indigenous doctor, and that really, by the way, the kid and her, you freeze that picture. That's what one of these individuals, I guess it was Mr. Morris, was talking about. Is that it has to begin when they're in grammar school. They have to be thinking, I want to be a doctor.
Yeah.
I could be one.
Not just I want to be a doctor, but it's possible for me to be a doctor.
Yes. It's almost, again, we speak of this with athletes. We're noticing in professional sport how many of the really successful ones turns out that they were starting to play ball and to be coached by professionals when 9-10 years old. Mm-hmm. And so they're ready to go.
Yeah.
But yes, the community having a sense, we make our own doctor. We grow our own.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that must, the first guy that said it must have thought, I must be mad. now, this is a very wonderful book, Nothing Ordinary, the story of the Northern Ontario School of Medicine. Larry, we have time enough to, I think there was a passage in there that you wanted, we talked about doing, which is addresses the economic impact of this project is also pertinent. If I got the passage right, but you could read any passage.
Well, the passage I was going to read was actually a setup for, are we still being recorded? Because it was a setup for a much longer discussion. I don't know if you got time for that.
Yeah.
The economic impact, though, I won't read a passage. The economic impact is one of the mayors of one of the towns described to me. He said, if you have a doctor in town, a company can decide on that basis that, yes, they'll set up a plant there because their workers will get healthcare. Okay, so it's all part of a continuum of creating community. If you don't have a doctor, you're not going to get that economic. You're not going to get that economic development because people are going to say, well, if I get appendicitis, where am I going to go, right? So, that's a factor of the whole continuum of communities surviving and communities having economic prospects for their futures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it's the they're the anchor, right?
It's an anchor. It's an anchor position.
Yeah. You know, it's very smart, I'm you of course must be. You're a rural person. I can out you that way. Myself, I'm rural.
Yeah, and, I'm rural.
And this, the individual, the visionary here, he came from, this was the project, rural medicine mm-hmm. in Australia. And he's very at home with Northern Ontario. He looks in and he says, oh, yeah, that's my people.
Yeah. He's in New Zealand right now, but
but he's a refugee, I take it. Yeah.
Well, he retired from being the dean 2 years ago, and now he's taken up a position in New Zealand. But yes, and rural medicine is different from urban medicine, and you don't when I go to a doctor in Toronto, basically they run a bunch of tests and then start sending me to various specialists. If you're in some rural small town way off from God knows how far from anywhere else, your local person or your local little health team has got to have diagnostic aptitudes of their own and a lot of thinking on their feet and a lot of general practitioner skills.
Yeah. They're the teachers. So the doctors, existing doctors, Northern Ontario, are faculty members. Am I right?
Yeah, the third year students spend months and months out in. There are two factors that are kind of interesting. The third year students go and do. I can't quite remember what they're called. Not residencies, but they hook up with a practitioner in some small town. They're there for. That's part of the longitudinal. Study thing. They're there for months and months and months and become part of the practices. Much earlier than that, this was kind of a neat thing. All of the first year students, every single first year student, late in their first year, is sent off to spend a month on a First Nation.
Yeah.
Not practicing medicine because they I haven't got the training to practice medicine, but just to go and live in a community that they might never have encountered before.
Yes.
And to absorb and blow their minds. And that's they all come back changed people.
And their instructor does too. One of the things I was struck by in the book was that the doctors who were training said, "I'm a better doctor when I'm teaching."
Because that too,
I'm explaining to the patient. I'm explaining to my assistant or the trainee what I'm doing, and very often the patient said, "Oh, that's what I wanted to know."
When
you talk to me, I didn't understand. When you talk to him, I'm getting it. Yeah. So you have a tripartite. You have the patient and the But I that's fascinating to see people telling the story of how they got involved in a project where they begin to learn themselves, and all testify to the general improvement as a result of this program. So anyway, it's an inspiring story. Larry Krotz, the author of Nothing Ordinary, The Story of the Northern Ontario School of Medicine. Great book, lovely cover. They say you can't judge a book by its cover, but this is a great cover, and you can. So Larry, thanks very much.
Thank you, Phil.
A lot of fun. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT. We'll be right back.